You're listening to Midori House, first broadcast on the 28th of March 2014 on Monocle 24. Hello and welcome to Midori House, coming to you live from Studio One here in London. I'm Tom Edwards. On today's programme, 3 weeks on and still no sign of Malaysia Airlines Flight 370.
The Australian authorities have indicated that they have shifted the search area approximately 1,100 kilometres to the northeast.
Ivor Gaber and Matthew Jameson will join me to share their views on the changing search for the plane. Plus, we wrap up the day's other big stories, including President Obama trying to build bridges in Saudi Arabia and why most of the world's largest news organisations are being targeted by hackers. Then we'll be in Istanbul to preview this weekend's important mayoral election, and we'll learn why Prime Minister Erdogan may be holding his breath.
So every night, Turks gather around YouTube and listen to the latest wiretap recordings of their Prime Minister. So we are in the middle of an absolutely off-the-charts, absurd conflict.
Plus, we'll be hitting the streets of London to hear why classic pieces of fine art are being transformed with a modern twist, all using spray paint. And finally, it's a Friday, so that can only mean it's time to head to the cinema.
Captain America needs my help.
When do we start?
We just did.
More of that later. We'll catch up with Monocle's film expert on the must-see movies this week. That's all ahead on this edition of Midori House with me, Tom Edwards. Plenty to look forward to then in the next hour here on Midori House. Before we begin, let's get the latest world news. Here's Bill Bingham.
Monocle 24 News. Barack Obama is calling on Moscow to pull its military back from Ukraine's border and begin talks to defuse tensions in the region. Russia is believed to have gathered a force of several thousand troops close to Ukraine's eastern frontier. A Russian security official says intelligence measures are being stepped up to counter Western threats to Moscow's influence. The US president has been speaking to CBS News at the end of a visit to Europe, where the United States, Germany, France, Britain, Italy, Japan and Canada warned Russia it faced additional sanctions if it takes further action to destabilize Ukraine. Mr. Obama says the build-up may be a precursor to further Russian action.
It may simply be an effort to intimidate Ukraine, or it may be that they've got additional plans. And in either case, what we need right now to resolve and de-escalate the situation would be for Russia to move back those troops and to begin negotiations directly with the Ukrainian government as well as the international community.
Australian authorities have released an image taken by search aircraft looking for flight MH370 in the Indian Ocean. The image shows two apparently white objects, one rectangular and one circular, floating in the sea inside a new search area for the missing plane. It comes after the search for the Malaysia Airlines plane was shifted following new data which suggested it may not have travelled as far south as previously thought. The new finds will need to be confirmed by personnel on board ships involved in the search. That's expected to happen on Saturday when the Chinese patrol ship Haixun 01 arrives in the area. Royal Australian Air Force Flight Lieutenant Josh Williams is on board one of the five aircraft directed to the new search area.
The objects are very distinctive and definitely man-made objects. Just using our basic analysis there from the guys down the back, the fact that they're floating also is a positive sign. We are unable, however, to determine whether they are it is wreckage from the aircraft.
Central African Republic officials say a grenade attack on a funeral in Bangui has killed 20 people. The attack happened in the Republic's capital at around 2300 on Thursday. 11 people were injured in the attack. Reports from Bangui say former fighters from the Seleka militia were behind the attack. The country's been hit by civil conflict since Seleka rebels ousted the president in March 2013. Afghan military sources say an attack by the Taliban on a guest house in Kabul has come to an end. Police have killed the last gunman inside. At least four people were reported trapped inside the guest house during the attack, which was stopped by Afghan special forces after fighting which lasted for much of Friday. One news agency, AFP, has reported a girl has been killed. Security has been tight in the Afghan capital 1 week before a presidential election. Norway's ex-Prime Minister Jens Stoltenberg has been appointed NATO's next Secretary General, replacing Denmark's Anders Fogh Rasmussen. He'll take over as leader of the 28-nation military alliance in October, when Mr. Rasmussen steps down after a NATO summit in Wales. Mr. Rasmussen has been head of NATO for the past 5 years. Italy's government is selling off hundreds of limousines used by government officials in an online auction on eBay. 151 cars for sale have been posted. Among them are dozens of BMWs, Alfa Romeos and Lancias. There are also 9 high-powered Maseratis owned by the Defence Ministry and 2 Jaguars. That's the latest news on Monocle 24.
Thank you very much indeed, Bill. Bill Bingham will return with some world news headlines for you at the bottom of the hour. Right now, at 6 minutes past the hour here in London, you're listening to Midori House on Monocle 24, and we're back right after this.
London, Toronto, Tokyo.
Hong Kong, Zurich, London.
Londres, Toronto, Tokyo. Essa é a Monocle 24.
Hong Kong, Zurich, London. Das ist Monocle 24. Hong Kong,
Hong Kong,
Zurich,
London,
Londres. Questo è Monocle 24.
Hong Kong, Zurich, London. Tu vai a Monaco, vada a City Check.
From London,
London. London,
caro.
This is Monocle 24.
You're listening to Midori House. It's just ticking towards 18.07 here in London, 14.07 in New York City. Joining me now with their take on the big news stories of the day. Here in the studio are Ivor Gaber, Director of the Political Journalism Programme at City University, and Matthew Jamieson from the Royal United Services Institute here in London. Welcome both to the programme. We'll begin with the story that's been dominating the headlines over the past 3 weeks, the search for missing Malaysia Airlines flight MH370. Earlier today, the search area shifted more than 1,000 kilometres northeast as new data showed the plane had been travelling faster than previously thought. Before I bring you both in on this, let's recap the developments from the past few weeks with Monocle's Phil Hahn, who's filed this report.
Saturday, March 8th, Malaysia Airlines Flight 370 departs from Kuala Lumpur International Airport on schedule at 12:41 a.m. local time en route to Beijing. The Boeing 777 is carrying 227 passengers and 12 crew members. Most of the passengers are Chinese nationals. The aircraft was flying in good weather conditions when suddenly it disappeared.
Search and rescue operations underway for a missing Malaysia Airlines plane, which is reported to have crashed into the sea off Vietnam.
Sunday, March 9th. Authorities believe MH370 may have turned back from its route as the search area widens. Interpol releases information that 2 passengers were traveling on stolen passports.
Austria denied that one of its citizens was on the flight. That fellow was safe and had his passport stolen 2 years ago. Italy's foreign ministry confirmed none of its citizens was on board.
Both men are later identified as being Iranian, but that the missing flight was not a result of terrorism. Over the next few days, the search area shifts from Vietnamese waters to the South China Sea. Friday, March 14th, 1 week later, an MH370 is still missing. White House spokesman Jay Carney tells reporters the search area is now moving.
It's my understanding that based on some new information that's not necessarily conclusive, but new information, an additional search area may be opened in the Indian Ocean, and we are consulting with international partners about the appropriate assets to deploy.
New satellite information revealed the plane flew up to 7 hours after losing contact. The focus shifts to the crew as authorities search the home of both pilots. By Wednesday, March 19th, investigators shift their focus to the southern Indian Ocean and also discover the aircraft took an abrupt U-turn. March 20th, Australian Prime Minister Tony Abbott says debris from MH370 may have been found.
The Australian Maritime Safety Authority has received information based on satellite imagery of objects possibly related to the search.
Despite an exhaustive search of the area, officials come up empty-handed. Friday, March 21st, 2 weeks since Malaysia Airlines Flight 370 disappeared, and still nothing. Monday, March 24th, Prime Minister Razak tells the families the worst.
Flight MH370 ended in the southern Indian Ocean.
grief and anger from those who lost loved ones spilling over. On March 25th, the search is stopped because of bad weather in the southern Indian Ocean. In Beijing, Chinese relatives protest outside the Malaysian embassy. Over the next few days, despite new images showing debris in the seas, nothing is found. By Friday, March 28th, the area shifts more than 1,000 kilometers northeast. 3 weeks into the search, and still nothing.
That was our Phil Hahn reporting, bringing us up to date, of course, with the well-documented developments of the last few weeks. Let me bring in my guests, both Ivor Gaber and Matthew Jameson. Ivor, we'll start with you. Phil, they're sort of charting the timeline of this incident. I think one thing that's been interesting is the coordination or lack of it that we've seen from all of these various authorities and actors involved in this. Do you think that has been problematic? Do you think that if there are lessons to be learned, I guess in more detail that will emerge over time, but in a broad sense, it's been problematic, hasn't it? The fact that there has been certain failures between nations to actually get the right information to the right people at the right time.
I think it's appeared problematic. But I think it's appeared problematic because we've come to expect in a globalised online world that there are going to be instant solutions to every problem. I mean, I've felt a great sympathy for Malaysians because actually, frankly, the answer to most of the questions is we don't know. That appears these days to be unacceptable. And even in that situation, I have to say, as somebody who knows very little about international rescue coordination, I mean, in one way, I'm rather impressed because nations are very careful about satellite tracking and radar and defence and things like this. And yet here we have, okay, it's taken a few days, countries coming together and collaborating, cooperating with hostile forces, in a sense, not necessarily friendly nations, and doing their very best, it seems to me. So, yeah, it has looked problematic, but I think actually it's as good as it could be expected.
Matthew, that's interesting, isn't it, the point that Ivor makes there about actually some of the actors here are... It's certainly, maybe not enemies, but they're certainly not friends. And so perhaps we should be rather more complimentary about some of the cooperation we've seen. So certainly in terms of some of the emergency services, the way that, you know, European agencies who have specialisms in this area have fed into the situation. Do you think we should perhaps be rather more impressed perhaps by some of the endeavours, as Ivor suggests?
Well, yes, I think it's encouraging. It's a terrible, terrible tragedy. And I think perhaps one of the positives that we can see coming out of this is that certain nations have been pulling together and cooperating and collaborating and rallying around. And as you say, in that region, the Asia-Pacific region, it's a very sort of tense, jittery area of the world at the moment, with the huge geopolitical upheaval that's going on with the rise of China and the emergence of China as the dominant superpower in the area. And therefore, also, there's been a rise in Chinese nationalism and Japanese nationalism, and those two have been arguing over all sorts of issues to do with islands. So it's good to see that everybody has pulled together in the face of this tragedy.
It's obviously rather difficult to second guess. And we think back to recent examples of similar cases where we had the Air France jet that was lost over the South Atlantic several years, in fact, before the main body of that aircraft and the black box recorders were recovered. Do you think it's been problematic for the media, Ivor, to cover this story? Because almost inevitably, almost feel the media sometimes is chasing its tail, and there is a lot of speculation which is largely unfounded. Is that inescapable in a story that is understandably as compelling as this is?
I think it's been a hugely difficult story for the media on the one hand, and on the other hand, a very easy story. Easy because, I hate to say it, but human interest, you know, wailing relatives, fantastic, every day a different story. But hugely difficult because, A, the story's not really moved on. The basic position is we still don't really know. But every day there's a little bit more information. And I think that the media has done, I mean, terrible generalisation here, and I suppose we're mainly thinking about 24-hour TV news here because that's the main source of this sort of information. I think they've done as good as can be expected and better than one might have feared, because this is a story that hasn't really slipped down the news agenda a great deal. And frankly, 200 people of foreign nationality dying, I mean, it happened only a couple of days ago in, and this is to my shame, I can't remember which sub-Saharan African country, Uganda, a boat capsized, over 200 people died, and it barely made the bulletin. So there's a lot of attention here on non-Brits, 200 of them, which isn't a huge number by global standards. And yet, so, yeah, I'd give them bouquets. I think the media's done a good job.
Some sobering thoughts there about these other instances. I know that Ivor was fairly generous, actually, in his appraisal of the roles of some of these countries, but it has been a difficult time, hasn't it, Matthew, for Malaysia. Of course, it's a government airline, essentially, Malaysia Airlines.
Yes.
Do you think there have been the sort of early public relations gaffes in terms of the wrong sort of information emerging at the wrong time did do them some harm? Do you think that Malaysia has sort of work to do to maybe reconcile some of these problems, impress upon the international community that it's, you know, it is a country that's ready for business, it is in good order? Mm-hmm. Do you think they still have work to do?
I think they do. I mean, I feel sorry in a way for the Malaysians because they are a country that quite clearly is not developed and equipped to deal with this kind of disaster. And that's been really for all to see. They have at times seemed to be out of their depth, and it has been very confusing. Especially some of the press conferences that their government officials have run have been quite chaotic. But I do feel sorry for them because, you know, they're a country that is not at that level, really. And I think that they have got to learn from this, and they have obviously got some more work to do.
Indeed. And I'm sure some of those ideas will be discussed on our special edition of The Foreign Desk with Steve Bloomfield. You'll be able to hear that Saturday at noon London time here on Monocle 24. Let's move on to another story making headlines today. I guess this is sort of good old-fashioned geopolitics for us to get stuck into next. President Obama has been visiting Riyadh in an attempt at some rapprochement with Saudi Arabia. Something of a whirlwind visit, just one evening with King Abdullah. Matthew and Ivor, I mean, relations between the US and Saudi have soured somewhat. I don't know if they're at their lowest ebb, it would be fair to say. But Matthew, it is interesting, isn't it, that Obama's gone on this trip. Do you think he'll be successful, or does that rather depend on what his true objectives are?
That's a good question, because I don't think personally, if his objective is to reassure the Saudis and they get them back on side and everything's going to be sweetness and light again, I don't think he will be successful, because the Saudis have now a very deep ingrained skepticism and lack of confidence in Mr. Obama. They have, especially over Syria, Iran, and they are also increasingly worried that the Obama administration is disengaging from the Middle East. But President Obama, in a way, might not really need to worry too much in the long term about what the Saudis really think, because, of course, there's this huge energy revolution that is going on in America with the shale fracking, and they will become energy independent, perhaps, or certainly they will not need as much oil from the Middle East. And of course, that goes to the very heart of the strategic relationship that started between America and Saudi Arabia in 1945. At the very heart of that bargain was, you give us oil and keep the oil flowing, and we will give you a security guarantee in return. But, you know, in years to come, the United States won't really need too much Saudi oil anymore.
It's interesting how these things often boil down to energy.
I'm just going to pick up on. It was interesting. Matthew is an expert in this area. I'm a mere observer. It was interesting what Matthew didn't mention, because had we had this conversation about an American president visiting Saudi 5 years ago, top of the agenda would be Israel. Hmm. Now, is Israel-Palestine dispute, and I'm certainly not seeking to undermine it, but it's become a sideshow compared to these other forces, the Shiite-Sunni issue, obviously linked to Iran, linked to Syria, linked to the Arab Spring. And yet, and of course, we know that actually, yet again, the Israel-Palestine negotiations seem to be going nowhere, despite great efforts by the Secretary of State. So I just wonder, and I'm desperately looking for a tiny shaft of light in a pretty gloomy situation, is this removing Israel-Palestine dispute from centre stage, is that actually going to be helpful, at least in moving that dispute along, even if the other bigger disputes remain centre stage?
Well, what do you think about that? I guess it's a sort of it's a compelling question to ask, isn't it? What would your instincts tell you?
I have some knowledge of Israeli politics, and you can't talk about Israel as a monolithic society in the way perhaps one can in terms of Saudi, in terms of the leadership. And although Netanyahu is clearly a very right-wing politician, he's also a pragmatist. And there are forces developing in Israel, particularly those leading the negotiations with the Palestinians, Tzipi Livni particularly, who recognise that actually there is no alternative to a settlement, and if they don't do it with Abbas, the leader of al-Fatah, the alternatives are going to be worse. And so a little bit of me says, because it's not quite centre stage, there's a better chance, it's not a good chance, but it's a better chance that progress might be made towards some sort of two-state solution. But if you ask me what the shape of that two-state solution is, I can't answer that, because the Israelis have been building settlements so fast that it's very difficult to see what that map would look like other than a jigsaw, which would be very unsatisfactory to the Palestinians.
I mean, that's a very interesting point. And there was an interesting survey this week about the perceptions amongst certain younger generations of, I think, Palestinians and Israelis. And they, for the first time, were perhaps less certain than their parents about the idea that a formalised two-state solution was the only way out, because of exactly that problem, the difficulties in drawing these very fine fine lines. But that's an interesting point, Matthew, that Ivan makes about perhaps being shifted slightly off centre stage. Yeah. Is that a more profitable area for these sorts of discussions to happen?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, I completely agree with Ivor. The more that you can do to take these very difficult, complex, sensitive issues out of the hurly-burly of the 24/7 media and having it, you know, center stage in the great global theater of geopolitics, and the more you can move it to quiet, behind closed doors discussions, working things through, like they did with the Oslo agreement, which was done in complete secrecy, you know, through Norway in the early 90s. That really does help, because at the end of the day, then there is less room for playing to the gallery and for the egos to, you know, come out and make their points and play to their constituencies.
So just on this final point, going back to Obama's trip and his objectives then, is it more of a, not a sort of box-ticking exercise? Is it just political niceties, Ivor?
Well, I think given the strategic situation, if Obama came to Europe and didn't then go on to the Middle East, whichever bit of the Middle East, I think he'd face a very severe criticism at home. Is it box-ticking? To some extent, he's been there, and in fact, he's only there for a day. I think it would be very difficult for a US president to leave. Don't forget, leaving Washington, Obama's not been a great world traveller. He's not done a George, you know, George W. Bush trod the international stage more than Obama. So I think it would have been difficult for him at least not to have made a fleeting appearance in the Middle East, which is actually, he's doing no more than that.
We're going to take a very, very short break now. You're listening to Midori House with me, Tom Edwards, my guests Ivor Gaber and Matthew Jamieson. We'll come back in a moment or two. We'll discuss another problem facing Obama. He's got a lot in his in tray. The build-up of Russian troops near the border of Ukraine. Stay with us.
If you're after a soundtrack to your working day, look no further than Monocle 24's Globally Minded playlist. We play the very best upbeat music from around the world, around the clock, whether that's jazz from Japan, pop from Paris, house from Hamburg, or soul from Seoul. It's all picked by our team and presented by our editors. So get lost in music with Monocle 24's playlist right here, day and night, on Monocle 24.
Yes, you're listening to Monocle 24. It's Midori House. Still with me are Ivor Gaber and Matthew Jamieson, discussing some of the big stories of the day. We turn our attentions now to the crisis in Ukraine. A huge military build-up of Russian troops along the border continues. Earlier today, in an interview on CBS, Obama called on Vladimir Putin to de-escalate the crisis. Let's take a listen.
What we need right now to resolve and de-escalate the situation would be for Russia to move back those troops and to begin negotiations directly with the Ukrainian government as well as the international community.
Now, without wanting empty rhetoric to become something of a theme of today's programme, Matthew, no one's going to really listen. But certainly Vladimir Putin's not going to listen to Obama saying that kind of thing, is he?
No, I don't think that Mr. Putin will really listen. He's clearly not in a listening mood. And quite frankly, the Russian leadership really doesn't care a great deal what the West say over this, and their actions have shown that. But he will have to listen once, you know, very tough, hard-hitting economic sanctions start to bite and perhaps even cripple certain aspects of the Russian economy. Their stock market, of course, has been hit badly this week, and the ruble was coming under intense pressure throughout this. So I think they will have to listen when they start to get hit hard in their pocketbooks.
Two questions I wonder here, Ivor. One is, hard-hitting sanctions is one thing, but, you know, the real blow at the heart of the Russian money wouldn't perhaps even happen within Russian borders. It would probably happen here in the City of London, and there doesn't seem very much appetite to do that. Secondly, if Russia does push on yet further, what are the US or NATO or whomever it's going to be, what are they actually going to do about it? It seems to me that it's unlikely they're going to do very much.
Well, I think NATO must be very relieved that Ukraine's not a member of the alliance. Otherwise, we'd really have to do something about it. I think, though, if Russia wanted to move into Ukraine, I don't think there is anything we could do about it. Matthew talks about hard-hitting sanctions. They certainly are from the US, but the European Union, and particularly Germany, has been has pussyfooted on sanctions. And, yeah, a few oligarchs might find some of their assets frozen, but they haven't even taken that step yet. Mm. Just travel.
Do you think they might? Do you think is that the one missed opportunity to really exert some leverage?
I have to say, no, I don't think pressure on the oligarchs is going to bother Putin, frankly. And I think we're tending to miss the big picture. I think just taking one step back and not going to a history lesson, but I think the West grossly misplayed it after the fall of the Berlin Wall. That the encouraged, the IMF moved in and really humiliated that Russia by forcing it into mass privatizations, which led to, we created the oligarchs. We forced the Soviet government, as it was then, to sell off industry and enable the oligarchs to clean up. But the other important thing we did was we didn't just dent Russian pride, we severely damaged Russian pride. And don't forget, Russia has never had a democratic tradition, always felt somewhat alienated from Europe and from the West. And we collectively reinforced that. So what we're now seeing with Putin, and he might even say, I'll take the economic damage, but he is reasserting Russian pride, which is very important to Russian people. It's not dissimilar, and I won't go there much, but and Matthew correctly made reference to it, the Chinese view of life is not so much influenced by their communism as by their sense of Chinese nationalism. Again, that hurt goes back to the 19th century. Mm-hmm. But I think we have misread that. And Ukraine was very much part of the Russian consciousness. And if you look back in Russian history, Russia and Ukraine has never been, it was briefly independent for a few months, I think. It's always been part of either the Tsarist Empire or the Soviet Union. And I think we in the West grossly misread it, particularly in Washington. And we're now reaping the whirlwind.
Matthew, sort of nodding along with that, it's interesting, isn't it? I just wonder if you are largely in accord with that sort of summary of certainly the Putin worldview. Where does that Russian nationalism end then? We've speculated a little on this programme about, you know, could he possibly consider, you know, there's other areas people have mentioned, going so far as Latvia and actually talking about NATO member states without any question. That surely wouldn't happen. What would be the limits then of this expression of Putin's nationalism?
Yeah, I think the limits to Putin's nationalism is NATO member states. I don't see Russia taking on a NATO member state and invading, you know, the Baltic states and so on, because then we would have to come to their aid. We will be under treaty obligations under Article 5 of the North Atlantic Treaty to come to the aid of a fellow member state that has been invaded. So I think he will leave unmolested the NATO member states. I do agree with part of Ivor's analysis, absolutely. Well, I agree with all of it, actually. But in terms of, first of all, Naomi Klein outlined this brilliantly in her book, The Shock Doctrine, about the flood of neoliberal free market economics into Moscow and the botched corrupt privatizations which have resulted in this small elite group of sort of mafiosos controlling so much wealth in the country. And we are partly responsible for that because we forced them too quickly down this extreme laissez-faire, you know, free market road. However, and Ivor is correct about their mindset is very proud and nationalistic. But, you know, I think really we have to get the Russians moving in a different direction because we in Europe, of course, have largely moved beyond nationalism into a postmodern state of being through the European Union. Nationalism is dangerous. Nationalism is bad. And hubris and pride, when it's taken to the extreme form in Mr. Putin, as we've seen, he's a complete megalomaniac. These tendencies and psychological worldviews are very, very destructive. And we've seen it also when the United States becomes very nationalistic as well, especially after 9/11 and makes mistakes and lashes out. So we have got to encourage the Russians and to make them see that their future prosperity does not lie in trying to create some sort of recreation of the old Soviet Union. They are no longer a superpower. They lost the Cold War. They have to come to terms with that. And they also have to come to terms with integrating themselves into the world economy. And if they do that, they will have much more prosperity and benefits. And they don't need to worry about countries along their border and maybe, you know, becoming part of the European Union or NATO. If that's what those countries want to do, then that's their choice. And it's no business of Russia to interfere anymore with that. And that's what they've got to learn. And they've also got to learn that they have nothing to fear from the West. We don't want to invade Russia, and we don't want Russia to be under our thumb. We want to work with Russia, but they have got to get out of their heads these 19th century principles, which have no place in today's world of might makes right. They have got to respect international law, and also they've got to move in a much more democratic tradition, though, as Ivor, again, quite rightly pointed out, there has been really no history of democracy in Russia, and we're seeing that quite clearly now.
Those are the insights of Matthew Jameson from the Royal United Services Institute. Before that, we were hearing from Ivor Gaber from the City University. Gentlemen, we have to leave it there, but thank you both very much indeed for joining me here on Friday's edition of Midori House.
Vanuit London, dit is Monocle 24.
London으로부터 Monocle 24입니다.
De Londres, essa é a Monocle 24.
Where you, London? This is Monocle 24.
Ut London, du er Monocle 24.
Fra London, dette er Monocle 24.
From London, this is Londres.
Hollanda.
London으로부터
Hong Kong.
Hong Kong.
Zurich.
London.
London.
This is Monocle 24.
And this is Midori House. Plenty still to come in today's programme. We'll preview this weekend's elections across Turkey. You'll hear the films you need to see at the cinema this weekend. And we'll take to the streets of London to find out why some classic pieces of fine art have gone a bit more modern. Before that, let's hear from Bill Bingham, who's got the latest world news headlines.
Barack Obama is calling on Moscow to pull its military back from Ukraine's border and begin talks to defuse tension in the region. Russia is believed to have gathered a force of several thousand troops close to Ukraine's eastern frontier. A Russian security official says intelligence measures are being stepped up to counter Western threats to Moscow's influence. Australian authorities have released an image taken by a search aircraft looking for flight MH370 in the Indian Ocean. The image shows two apparently white objects, one rectangular and one circular, floating in the sea inside a new search area for the missing plane. It comes after the search for the missing Malaysia Airlines flight was shifted following new data which suggested it may not have travelled as far south as previously thought. Central African Republic officials say a grenade attack on a funeral in Bangui has killed 20 people. The attack happened in the Republic's capital at around 2300 hours on Thursday. 11 people were injured in the attack. Afghan military sources say an attack by the Taliban on a guest house in Kabul has come to an end. Police have killed the last gunman inside. At least four people were reported trapped inside the guest house during the attack, which was stopped by Afghan special forces. Norway's ex-Prime Minister Jens Stoltenberg has been appointed NATO's next Secretary General, replacing Denmark's Anders Fogh Rasmussen. He'll take over as leader of the 28-nation military alliance in October, when Mr. Rasmussen steps down after a NATO summit in Wales. Those are the latest headlines on Monocle 24.
Thank you very much indeed, Bill. And Bill Bingham will return with a full bulletin of world news for you at the top of the hour. That's 1900 hours here in London. Right now, though, you're with Midori House live here on Monocle 24. And it's time to check in with one of our correspondents around the world. Today, we head to Istanbul. The country is heading to the polls this weekend in municipal elections, being seen as something of a test for Prime Minister Erdogan's popularity. Joining us for the latest is Monocle's contributor in the city, Caleb Lauer. Caleb, thanks for joining us. As always, tell me, these are local elections. It's not a general election, yet they are indisputably being seen as something of a referendum on the PM. Why is that exactly?
Well, that's because Turkey is in the middle of a unprecedented crisis right now. There are protests, as people know and people have seen on the news. There are corruption allegations which have been prevented from being investigated further by the government. And there is this nasty fight in the media happening right now. These local elections are the first elections since Gezi Park protests in the summer, and they're the first elections since these corruption allegations surfaced, which means that they are the first opportunity for voters to actually say something about what they think of their government. That's why these votes for mayor, for village mayors, for local headmen, local headwomen are being cast as a referendum on the prime minister. And the prime minister is not actually running, but the result of these elections will determine his political future.
And Caleb, we're talking about nasty conflicts. There are a number, of course, of these caught up in this election, including one between two former allies. Tell us exactly what that conflict looks like.
The conflict is between the government, led by Prime Minister Erdogan, and, as you say, one of his former allies, a man named Fethullah Gulen, who lives in America but is a leader of a religious movement in Turkey. Now, what happened in December was that these corruption allegations that no doubt many people have heard of were made public. The police tried to arrest a number of people very, very close to the government, including the sons of ministers. A number of ministers had to resign. The government's response to those allegations and response to that investigation was to reassign, transfer, and fire many, many police officers, police chiefs, and prosecutors, essentially neutralizing this investigation. The response of the Gulen movement, who many people assume are behind the investigation because they have many followers in the police forces, went another route. And what they started doing was posting the recordings, the wiretapped recordings of the prime minister and his associates on YouTube. So every night, Turks gather around YouTube and listen to the latest wiretap recordings of their prime minister. Now, this has resulted in the response from the government, which has been to shut down Twitter and last night shut down YouTube. So we are in the middle of an absolutely off-the-charts, absurd conflict. And this is the context in which we go to the polls on Sunday.
It's pretty astonishing stuff. I mean, how would you characterize then exactly what is at stake for the government in this at the ballot box then? What's at stake for them?
Yeah, you can't overstate what's at stake for the government. This is about the AK Party, the governing party's future. Now, I spoke with a man named Ersin Kalacioglu, who is a professor at Sabancı University, and he has been studying voter behavior for many, many years. And he had this to say about what's at stake.
The big question lurks. Can this political party afford to lose an election? Because the minute they do, the chances are that all of the front bench of the party will find themselves opposing a grand jury, answering these questions about the biggest embezzlement in Turkish history.
So what you're hearing here is the sense that A, these elections, if there is any hint of corruption, vote rigging, etc., the results will not be accepted, which means that this absolutely crazy episode that we've just been through leading up to these elections will essentially start another episode, which is what to do with the result. If the government wins, half the country is not going to be very impressed. If the government loses, that means we're going into even more uncertain territory.
And just to sort of look ahead then for us, Caleb, what does this territory look like? You said it's uncertain. In some ways, it's impossible to chart that course. But what do you anticipate we'll be seeing then in the coming weeks and months?
Well, there's two key races to watch. One is Istanbul and the other is Ankara. If the government loses Ankara and or Istanbul, there will be many, many questions about whether or not the prime minister has become a liability for his own party. This means that the party will start, if there are major losses like Ankara and Istanbul, the party will start to look at its own leader. And if the leader goes, the AK Party, many people may not know this, but the AK Party is not a monolith. It is a coalition of many different groups held together by this charismatic prime minister. If that charismatic prime minister goes, then there's a good chance that that party splits, which means that this juggernaut of the AK Party, which has ruled Turkey for more than 10 years, will no longer be. And we have two more elections to go before next summer.
Caleb Lauer in Istanbul, thank you very much indeed for joining us. And be sure to tune into Monocle 24 on Monday for analysis of the results. Up next, we'll be hitting the streets to hear why classic pieces of fine art are taking a modern twist. Stay tuned to find out more on this episode of Midori House here on Monocle 24.
The Monocle app puts Monocle 24's pacey mix of current affairs, business, culture and music in your pocket. Whether it's midnight in Marunouchi or sunrise in Sydney, tune in to our around-the-clock audio service live from Midori House. Or download and replay your favourite programmes using the Timeshift feature. also at your fingertips, our complete global travel guide. Get all this and more on the go on the Monocle app.
Welcome back to Midori House with me, Tom Edwards. Now it's time for us to hit the streets of London for a little bit of art. Not perhaps where you might expect to find it, but listen on. Here's a question. How do you turn classic pieces of fine art from Christ carrying the cross to the Massacre of the Innocents and give it a bit of a modern twist? Well, what you do is you get some of the leading street artists of our day to recreate them, often only in part. A new book titled Street Art, Fine Art is a beautiful collection of works from the walls and pavements of the London neighbourhood of Dulwich. And I'm delighted to say the woman behind the new book is here with me now. It's Ingrid Beasley. Ingrid, welcome to Midori House. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you very much.
Now, I often say, oh, this wonderful new book, and it's such a delightful thing. I really mean it this time. This is one I was leafing through, and it's absolutely superb. But perhaps before we talk about anything too specific, just remind us of the background to this project. Why did you think it was so important to get street artists to bring the fine art from the Dulwich Picture Gallery to sort of a wider audience? What was the objective there?
Well, I work at Dulwich Picture Gallery, and it has the most wonderful collection of Baroque art. But it's not really that trendy, and I've noticed that when people go into the gallery, they love it. And I like talking about the works of art in the gallery. But to encourage younger people and people who have perhaps not heard of Dulwich and are put off by the lack of public transport, etc., is really quite difficult. But they will follow street artists, and I encourage street artists to come to Dulwich, and they did their works based on the Dulwich Picture Gallery paintings, and it attracted a whole new audience, really, to Dulwich and to Dulwich Picture Gallery. And that was fantastic. It's breaking down prejudice in art, really.
And there were a pretty sort of incredible list of street artists involved. We've actually talked a little before about Thierry Noir and his work in Berlin on the Berlin Wall. Amazing names from all around the world. Was that a challenge to get people to come to Dulwich? I mean, I should remind our international listeners, this is sort of leafy suburb in the south of London, perhaps not on the main sort of art trail usually, apart from the connoisseurs, of course. Was it a challenge to get those people on board, or did they actually really warm to the task?
Well, it varied. I must put in a little plug for my business partner at this point, Richard Howard Griffin. He really was the one who knew the artists, and he was the one that invited them to come to Dulwich. I had the role more of showing them the pictures in Dulwich Picture Gallery and getting the walls for them, because I know people in Dulwich. But he was quite lucky, I think, in some respects, in that the international artists happen to be passing through London. That's really how it works. Sometimes you have to pay for their flights. And I think
they're the same the world over.
Yes. but yes, it was really due to him and one other person that we managed to get such an amazing array of artists.
And it was an incredible array of art that was on the streets. There was this house that, as you mentioned, that was decorated in incredible style inside and out. And this new book obviously sort of documents that, documents the processes and documents the astonishing work. Some of my personal favourites, I think the vase with flowers piece, a really incredible sort of reinterpretation of a masterwork.
Absolutely, by the one female artist, actually, Mad C from Germany, and she really did the most fantastic details. She picked them out of the Van Hoosum painting, which is 400 years old and very small, and she plastered a tennis practice wall with these beautiful leaves and flowers and little bugs, and her name, of course, as well, in among it all.
Absolutely. No, it's a fantastic piece of work. Now, tell me, I noticed that the copy I'm leafing through has it's a very clever cover. It's got one of these old masterworks with the sort of a superimposed image of one of these new interpretations upon it. So it's a very, very elegant piece. But you have one like that as well. But you also have a blank copy. Now, tell me, that looks like it could be soon to bear something exciting. Explain to me how that works.
Yes, it is. Well, we had 150 copies printed with blank covers, and this is for the artists themselves to decorate. So, in fact, there are 17 artists in this book, and when you do your sums, it's something like 9, I think. Well, don't do your sums, because one or two will never do it because they're miles away. But basically, these are...
A rough approximation will do, basically.
Absolutely. Yeah. These are for the artists to paint individually, and they hopefully will be sold at really quite a high price, and every penny will go to the artists.
Fantastic. So it seems to me as a sort of a win-win situation. You know, the gallery gains additional attention, so that not just the connoisseurs, but other people in the local community and from further afield, I imagine, will be attending. Have you noticed that? Have you seen it really stoking a sort of an international audience? Has the audience changed in a demonstrable way, do you think?
Well, the actual people that enter Dulwich Picture Gallery, it's hard for me to judge myself. I have asked a few attendants and the people at the desk, ticket desk, and they say, yes, initially anyway, there was really quite a large increase in numbers of people who wouldn't otherwise have come to the picture gallery. They came in asking about the street art, and that's how, you know, they discovered that. I also did some walks, which were incredibly popular, and they were promoted in the East End, and people came pouring down from the East End, and I had 100 on one once. And a show of hands showed that about 10% had been to Dulwich Picture Gallery before, and all the others were new attendants. So, you know, yes, it has worked incredibly well.
And I just wonder what this sort of appetite is then to continue with these kinds of, I call them experimental projects, but slightly bolder projects with a bit of a bolder creative vision, and to do something a bit, you know, a bit sort of from left field. Do you think that it's quite liberating, really? You know, working in a gallery space, sometimes there are people who are maybe a little reticent about doing things that are so bold. Do you think that it's really helped you to kick on? Can you be more expansive, perhaps, in your ideas? Could it be an even bigger canvas, perhaps, next time around?
Are you talking about Dulwich Picture Gallery itself, or
specifically for Dulwich Picture Gallery, but perhaps for museums more broadly? Do you think that when they see the success of this kind of program, they'll say, "Well, hang on, why don't we get a bit of that action?"
Yes, I think I certainly know that the National Gallery and the Royal Opera House have plans to use one of our street artists, which is fantastic. I think street art is becoming more and more mainstream. I don't know whether street artists like that idea or not, but it really is. Museum of London, I think, is doing a family festival with street artists and so forth. So, yes, it's a very accepted form of art. And it's spreading to the mainstream and the major museums and galleries.
And I think if people want to know why it's spreading so rapidly, they should pick up Street Art, Fine Art. Ingrid Beasley, the woman behind this brilliant book, thank you very much for coming to join us here on Midori House.
Thank you.
You're listening to Midori House here on Monocle 24, and it's Friday, so what better time to discuss the weekend's big movie openings than today, of course. Joining me in studio, I'm delighted to say, with all of her picks on what films we should or perhaps should not be heading to see in the cinema, is Monocle's movie expert, Karen Krzanovich. Karen, welcome to the programme. Thanks for being here, as always.
Always.
Shall we start in the past, as it were? Do you see what I've done there?
I like that. It's, you know, this is why you make the big bucks.
If only. But the past, Le Passé, by Asghar Farhadi. Tell us a little more about this one.
Well, Farhadi came to prominence generally, although About Eli in 2009 was really, really good. Most people know him for The Separation, A Separation, which, again, he revisits these themes in the past. The Separation got him Oscar-noted, nominated, and winning, actually, which is pretty good, considering he works primarily, and in this film, he works in French, and the other one he worked in Iranian. But this is about, again, revisits the themes of families coming apart. Here we've got Ali Moussada, who is coming back from Tehran to see Berenice Bejo. And it's one of these awkward situations that happens, I think, a lot these days, where a couple separates. They have children or not together. They have a home. And they come back to sort out the divorce. And instead of having him stay in a hotel, the ex-wife, soon-to-be ex-wife, says, stay with us, stay with the kids. But her boyfriend is also there with his child. And the interesting thing about this is that it sounds like, oh, it's going to be a total mess. But it's very, very quiet, but very revealing. And it's very much like a separation in that regard. You don't get any explosions or, you know, cars crashing into each other or anything like that. But you do see how the children react to this, and also how the parents are dealing with this kind of trauma. And actually, what's very interesting about this particularly is that the children get equal weighting, and some of the performances by the kids are great.
Do you sort of enjoy the fact that you have a director like this who's received quite a bit of critical acclaim, Oscar winning, as you mentioned? Presumably, there's quite a lot of pressure to change in some way, maybe take on more commercial projects. Someone like Farhadi, who then makes another movie that continues to play to the strengths that he showed before, hasn't changed too drastically. Is that reassuring, or do you think maybe when directors have the opportunities that one presumes must come their way after that kind of recognition, they should maybe push the envelope a little more?
Well, he sounds like a very balanced guy from the interviews. I haven't personally met him, but he's moving. He hasn't made a movie in English yet. I'm not aware of. This is his sixth feature, and he seems to be finding these universalities and moving from into European cinema. He didn't go to Hollywood and sell out. I'm sure he's been offered. I'm sure he's been offered all sorts of things. But I think he's working with what fascinates him, and I think that's very interesting. And he was saying, he said that there's a quote that he said, "Classical tragedy was the war between good and evil. We wanted evil to be defeated and good to be victorious. But the battle in modern tragedy is between good and good, and no matter which side wins, we'll still be heartbroken." And I'm not really sure Hollywood's ready for that message.
I think almost certainly not.
It might go up someday.
That's Le Passé, Asghar Farhadi's movie. Let's move on to something that, now I imagine, might be a little more of a traditional good versus evil battle. Captain America 2, The Winter Soldier. Tell us about this one.
Oh, gosh. It's getting mixed reviews, I have to say, but the people who are fans of Marvel and also the Avengers franchise, this is probably going to be the biggest and best franchise, or at least the most earning franchise since Bond.
Wow.
This is I don't know what part it is in what expanding universe it is of Marvel, but this is the second time that we're going back to see Captain America, and it's actually quite a political film. Unusually, Le Passé, you would think, should be a moral or political film. It's actually not. This is much more moral and political than Farhadi. We've got Steve Rogers. He is a frozen veteran from World War II. He's actually 95 years old, cryonically sleeping and awoken, given a totally supercharged body. This is Chris Evans, by the way, looking. He's very, very clean-cut Mr. America kind of guy, but not with a big jaw or anything like that. And he's come back basically to join S.H.I.E.L.D., I'll just say S.H.I.E.L.D. with Scarlett Johansson, who's another fellow operative. And then we've got Fury, who, of course, is Samuel L. Jackson.
Hmm.
And there is trouble afoot because Robert Redford is the bad guy. And that's not a surprise. So,
let's take a little bit of a listen then to a little bit from Captain America 2.
Are you ready? All it takes is one step.
People are gonna die. I can't let that happen.
Captain America needs my help. When do we start?
We just did.
Sounds kind of like you know what you're going to get with that one. Tell me a little bit more about Robert Redford. Does he deliver? I'm a big fan of
Robert
Redford. Did
you see All Is Lost?
I'm a big fan, and I haven't seen
that. You haven't seen it. Okay, see that. He's wonderful in it. He's very good in this, and actually, he's a good actor. He's got an amazing body of work. I don't want to say this in a bad way, but he's quite a worthy actor in a way. He's very serious about filmmaking. It's great to see him in something this commercial again, which is wonderful. And yes, he's terrific. Also, Jenny Agutter. Surprise, surprise. Her character doesn't even have a name. It's just World Security Council leader. Member something.
That's good.
But
some people are so important they don't really need specifics.
She doesn't.
It's like bogged down in specifics.
It's like Kate Bush appearing in the film. That'd be wonderful. There's Toby Jones as well. You just heard the second voice about Captain America needs my help. That's Anthony Mackie, who is tremendous. There's really a lot of good players, and Toby Jones is basically a generated voice in a box, which is astounding. This is a great fun film. I saw it in 3D. The 3D worked really well. If you sit through the credits to see there's an end sequence that you should see, it's not that great. But there's like a million designers on this film. And Joe Johnston, is famous for doing these special effects driven films. He did Rocketeer, for example, Honey, I Shrunk the Kids. It was a long time ago now. Jumanji, October Sky, Hidalgo. It's a workmanlike piece of feature filmmaking. It's great fun. There's a lot to watch, and there's a character called Bucky in it.
What's not to enjoy?
What's not to like?
Let's move on to the third picture, 20 Feet from Stardom. Tess, we've had a couple of sort of movies about, you know, the people behind the stars behind the really big stars. Is this another in that sort of order?
Yes. Now, this is not Russell Crowe's band, which is called 30 Odd Feet of Grunts. Okay, so this is not that. This is an Oscar-winning documentary, which is kind of, and actually was kind of a surprise that this film won, because this is the least serious, quote unquote, of the nominees this year. This was made by Morgan Neville, who's produced 28 various music documentaries. He's directed 20. He's written a lot. He's won 3 Grammys, or nominated for 3 Grammys. This is a serious filmmaker who loves music, knows a lot about music. And this is basically about the women that you hear on Rolling Stone's Gimme Shelter. Or you'll hear, as the lines from Lou Reed's song go, you know, the Carla girls go do-do-do-do-do-do. That's about the women who are going do-do-do. And it's terrific to see the caliber of singing, and also why they didn't become stars. And it's an analysis of that. It's very, very interesting. There's a certain level where you think, well, the other nominations, I shouldn't be talking about the Oscars, but I will. The other nominations were The Square, which was about the Turkish Rebellion. You think, you know what, isn't that kind of more important to get the Oscar? In a way, this is a very American story, although it's quite universal in the music industry. But it's interesting to see what happens to fame and talent and the mix of that.
Absolutely. Let's hear a little snapshot of this. This is from 20 Feet from Stardom.
You're supposed to be singing. There's a whole world out there who wants to hear you sing.
They're in the game and they stayed in the game, and they're legends.
It is my honor to induct into the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame, and about time to Miss Darlene Love.
Nice life-affirming stuff, and presumably not half bad soundtrack either, one imagines.
Oh, absolutely amazing. I mean, about halfway through, I was thinking to myself, you know, I mean, I do care about these women's careers, and I think it's an important story, and it's quite uplifting, but there is a lesson in here about the new music industry. For example, Darlene Love lost so much confidence that she started cleaning people's houses, and it was only when she was cleaning somebody's house and she heard her own voice over the radio she decided to get back into the business.
Wow, what a story. So Karen, if I put you on the spot, what should someone go and see then if they have the choice of these three movies this weekend? Do you have a personal favorite?
If you want to impress somebody and be European, go see The Past. If you want to have a good time, wear 3D glasses, eat some popcorn, go see Captain America. Particularly if you're American, I suppose you should go. And then if you really love music and you're serious about that, 20 Feet from Stardom. So you really can't lose this week.
It's a win-win-win situation. As always, when we welcome Karen Krasanovic to Midori House. Karen, thanks very much, as always, for being with us here on the program.
Thank you.
And that is all we have time for on today's Midori House. The programme was produced by Phil Hahn, research by Fernando Augusto Pacheco, Sarah Fournier and Carlotta Ribello, and our studio manager was Bill Luti. Next up is The Menu. This week has a bit of a coffee flavour to it. We'll meet the author of a book about caffeine, find out about a company importing Cuban beans, and we speak to Jeffrey Young, editor of the London Coffee Guide.
Coffee shops are about much more than coffee. They're about a human interaction. I often say that, you know, very few people come to a coffee shop specifically for the coffee. They're looking to be around other human beings. They're looking for that social experience.
That's coming up on The Menu next at the top of the hour. Also ahead, 2200 hours here in London is The Monocle Daily with Emma Nelson and Dominic Reynolds in the chairs tonight. This show will be back at the very same time on Monday. That's 1800 hours, of course, here in London. But for this edition of Midori House, from me, Tom Edwards, it's goodbye.
The Rolex Mentor and Protégé Arts Initiative sources young artists and brings them together with artistic masters for a year of mentoring. For mentors, it's a year to share their passion and expertise. For protégés, it's a once-in-a-lifetime opportunity to observe and work alongside some of the world's greatest artists. 1 year can inspire a lifetime. Rolex.